it's time to get things started on
the most sensational, inspirational, celebrational, motivational. This is what we call a Muppet Show.
This is America Weekend. I am Paul Harris, and that, of course, was the theme to The Muppet Show, which ran in syndicated form from 1976 to 1981, and along with Sesame Street, showed off the versatility of characters created by Jim Henson, the man behind the Muppets. And it has been on TV in some form or other, like Sesame Street, ever since. Jim Henson died in 1990 at age 53, but his legacy lives on through his company's continuing work and in a new biography by my next guest, Brian J. Jones, who was given rare access to the details of Henson's life and his TV shows and movies and his personal archives and much more to write this book. Brian, welcome to America Weekend.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thanks.
That show, The Muppet Show, was so fascinating to me because it worked on different levels for kids and for adults. Was that an ongoing theme of Henson's life?
Yeah, it really was. I mean, Jim, you know, The Muppet Show was really one of those studies in seductiveness for Jim, too, because he knew that it was going to work, and he knew that it would be family entertainment. You know, when Sesame Street came along and was so big, you know, he was starting to get sort of pigeonholed as a children's performer, and Jim, you know, really struggled with that label most of his life, in fact, but even up to that point, he always thought of himself as sort of a filmmaker, and, you know, had done commercials and documentaries and, you know, things in the 60s. So when he was trying to pitch The Muppet Show, he knew the show was going to work, and he knew it was going to work on all sorts of different levels. It was one of those, you know, it was this sophisticated show that didn't mind looking silly. Jim knew that show was going to work. He just needed to find somebody who believed in it as much as he did, and finally did with Lord Grade from London.
Did he pitch it to American networks and get rejected?
Oh, my gosh. He made two pilots. He found there was an executive at ABC in the early 70s named Michael Eisner who did believe in the project and financed actually what ended up being two pilots for The Muppet Show. Jim made one in the early 70s called The Muppet Valentine Show, which didn't really catch on. Followed that up with another one a year later called The Muppet Show Sex and Violence. Jim loved that title because it's sort of poking fun at his reputation. Neither of those really caught on. And, you know, a lot of people after two failed pilots would have said, you know, I'm chasing the dream. It's not going to work. Jim goes back and tries again and does this very, very funny pitch reel to executives at CBS for a Muppet Show, which you can actually find on YouTube. Very, very funny, calling these executives out by name, saying you need to buy the show, your product will take off, you'll have a 40 share. It's hilarious, it's funny, and still CBS didn't buy it.
Huh.
But again, it was finally Lord Grade who had sort of his scouts over in the United States looking for Jim. They believed in it and picked it up. And then, of course, the CBS networks picked it up immediately in the United States, and it was on almost every CBS-owned and operated station immediately following that. But, you know, again, a real study in perseverance for Jim. He knew this was going to work even after being told no sort of three times on it.
And he was right, because at one point in his run, it got so big that celebrities were begging him to let them guest star, right?
Oh, people were falling over themselves to get on the show. You know, it was sort of gave you, like, your coolness quotient. Like, you know, that was the show to do. People were sending telegrams in saying, you know, I want to be on the show. Their agents were pitching them like crazy. You know, you had opera, after people saw Beverly Hills, you had opera stars trying to get on the show. You know, after Rudolph Nureyev did it and danced with a giant pig in Swine Lake, I think that was when people kind of thought, you know, all right, we get it. You know, this is a fun place to be. It's going to be a good time. And so people loved to do that show. Jim could turn them away if he wanted to at that point.
Now, I mentioned, of course, Sesame Street, which is another huge part of the success story of Muppet history. Is it true that at the beginning, the people who made Sesame Street did not want the Muppets interacting with the human characters?
Yeah, the way they originally envisioned it is, you know, some of the academics had said you can't have them crossing over because, you know, you can't have the fantasy element overlapping with the reality. The kids won't be able to make that transition. So they sort of kept the Muppets in their very own separate segments. You would cut away, you'd go to Ernie and Bert, or cut away and you'd go to Cookie Monster, or something. They wouldn't overlap them. But what they found happened when they were doing this in the early test shows for it is as soon as you cut away from the Muppets and went back to the street, the kids started to tune out. So they knew immediately they had a problem. They had to figure out how to get Muppets on the street. And so Jim and a Sesame Street writer named John Stone sort of went away and came back and said, you know, Big Bird is going to be the embodiment of the child on Sesame Street. And then they also added Oscar. Sort of yin and yang characters on the street. But that was how they got characters onto the street. And then, of course, it soon followed that all of it started to trickle over onto the street at that point.
And did Jim Henson work on non-Muppet parts of Sesame Street?
Yeah, I really believe one of the ways they got him on that show was that they weren't going to tell. He didn't just have to do Muppet segments. Some of the first work he did for Sesame Street were those little short films, you know, for letters and numbers and parts of the body. What, you know, people my age always called the Baker films. You know, they would count to 10 and then they would run a number and they'd say 3, and then you'd see Jim juggling. He'd say 3 balls, and then Brian Henson would say 3 peas. And you know, on and on until the Baker fell down the stairs at the end, which Jim loved. So those were all his films. He did the film with the two cats coming into the dollhouse and wrecking everything, which when I was a little kid made me crazy because I thought everything was broken. But you know, that was one of his films. So they really allowed him to do a lot of these little short, sort of interesting, what Jim would have almost called experimental films at the time, which is sort of what he had come out of in the 1960s. He was perfect for this because he had done a lot of advertising. He knew how to get a message across very quickly, very funny, and keep your attention.
Now, in all the years of success that Jim Henson and the Muppets have had on all their various different projects, does his company and did he consider that year at the beginning of Saturday Night Live a low point?
No, not really. I mean, I think they were frustrated because they didn't get to write the segments. You know, he loved building those puppets. Like, he didn't necessarily build them all, but he sort of, like, came in and described them. He said, I want a mossy puppet, and I want to use real taxidermy eyes. So that was a real, you know, study in building for Jim. Like, they built some Muppets that didn't look like anything they'd done before. Almost a dry run for the puppets they would build for the Dark Crystal. But, you know, they weren't permitted to write for Saturday Night Live. So they were sort of at the mercy of SNL's writers, a lot of whom were performers. And, you know, every moment they gave to the Jim Henson Muppets was one less second they were going to get on the air. So it was sort of a bad DNA between the two of them. They got along fine. John Belushi loved them. He did end up calling the Muppets the Mucking Fuppets because they were fighting for airtime on there. But they got, personally, they all got along great. And it was just sort of a bad combination. And what happened after the first year is that was when Jim got his offer from Lord Grey to do the Muppet Show in London. So he was able to leave with his head high anyway and just say, you know, we got 24 shows guaranteed in London.
I did not know that the SNL writers were tasked with writing for the Muppets, but I did once hear a quote from Michael O'Donohue, who was the head writer and quite a character himself in that first year, who said, I don't write for felt.
Yeah, and sort of stalked out of the room. I mean, I think that's when they knew that, you know, their days were probably numbered over there. You know, I think Jim would have probably tried to extricate himself from that anyway, but again, was able to do so with his head held high because they did have the offer from Lord Grey. And every once in a while, you know, Jerry Nelson really dogged the bit with Scred singing with Lily Tomlin. That's a moment people always remember from that first season, and that was because Jerry Nelson sat in the room with the writers and just wrote it all week long and just kept it, as they always say, kept it up on the writer's board. So I think had they been allowed to write in, brought in somebody like Jerry Jewell, who was Jim's sort of go-to head writer, it might have been a little bit different. But as it was, because of the way union writing rules worked and so on, they couldn't write those episodes. Jim did sneak an episode in that he wrote himself, the very last episode where you see the SNL Muppets, where they sort of packed themselves up and put themselves away. Uh-huh. That was something Jim and Jerry Jewell wrote uncredited for it.
You mentioned singing, which was always a part of Muppet lore, and a song that Kermit sang, voiced by Jim Henson in the original Muppet movie, The Rainbow Connection, was nominated for an Oscar. But that's not the part of that movie that I remember vividly. I remember being in a movie theater, watching the movie, enjoying it on an adult level, and seeing the scene where Kermit is riding a bicycle. And,
right.
I can tell you, Brian, every single person in the theater where I was watching this said the same thing I did at the same time, which was, wow!
Yeah.
Because maybe it was the first time we had seen Kermit full length. You know, he'd always been sitting on something, but here he was not only riding the bicycle, but we saw him full length with his feet on the pedals and everything else and talking. And that was not at a time like now where you could just erase the wires digitally. How amazing was that for them to do?
Yeah, as Roger Ebert said in his review, he prefers to think Kermit did it himself. you know, that was actually the second time Jim had done it. They sort of snuck Kermit in on a bicycle on one of those failed Muppet Show pilots, so they knew how to do this. But Jim loved what they called those how they do that moments, and that's sort of one of the big how they do that moments in the Muppet movie. Also, apart from that opening scene where you see Kermit singing on the log and the only way you could perform it would be underwater, which Jim was, But for that scene, it was, you know, they were trying to do, there's a little bit of radio control in there, there's a little bit of strings, you know, holding him, there's a little bit of misdirection where you don't actually see Kermit riding the bike, you see, you know, Jim performing Kermit and think you see him on the bike. So there's a lot going on there. But yeah, ultimately they did have sort of they did have the option of having a remote control bike that would actually pedal itself with Kermit on it. Didn't always work the way they wanted it to work, so a lot of that is basically just basic marionette work and keeping stuff out of sight for you.
Let me touch on a couple of things from his personal life, and this is going to probably be the oddest question you've ever been asked about Jim Henson, but I'm curious. Were there such a thing as Muppet groupies? I don't mean kids.
Yeah, no, I don't have any that I can tell you about by name, but for example, when they were in London doing the first season of The Muppet Show, the English got it really fast. They loved The Muppets from almost day one, loved the fact that they were doing it there in London. And there were almost like Muppet groupies there. Jim always called it Muppet Mania. He said it's almost like a whole Beatlemania thing. And I actually called that chapter Muppet Mania because the British, I mean, they would follow them in the newspapers. And anytime they would introduce a new character, the British newspapers would write about it. Like, you know, like it was some big announcement. They would follow what they called the Muppet Men, you know, and do profiles of them, almost like Teen Beat, practically. I mean, they adored Jim and the Muppet performer, not just the Muppets, but the Muppet performers. They knew, you know, they talked about all of them in the papers. And Jim used to ferry his performers from their apartments and flats around London to Elstree in northern London in a bus that said The Muppet Show on the side. They actually had to take the label down off the side of the bus because it was getting mobbed at stoplights every time. I mean, it was the Beatles. I mean, it was Beatlemania. It was Muppet Mania in London for those, especially in those early years. They just went crazy for them over there.
Did controlling a Muppet make you hot with the ladies?
Who would have thought? Yeah, people just adore. You know, there's a reason that people wanted to be on the show, and there's a reason people, I think, mobbed the Muppet performers. It was just one of those things that it immediately felt familiar to you. So why wouldn't you go up and mob Jim Henson or Richard Hunt?
The other personal thing I've got to ask about is some of the controversy about the end of Jim's life in 1990. There are stories that he had gone an alternative medicine route, kind of like Steve Jobs did. There are stories that his Christian Science background was one of the reasons that he didn't get the help he needed at the end of his life. You've looked into all of this, I'm sure. What's the truth?
Yeah, well, the truth is none of the above on those. Jim's mother was Christian Science, and Jim had been raised as a child Christian Science, but was non-practicing for most of his adult life. So, you know, Jim didn't have an aversion to doctors or to medication or anything like that. Definitely not because of Christian Science, but just, you know, didn't appear in the first place. But, you know, I think a big part of it is the reason Jim didn't seek medical attention is two things. First of all, no one ever really believes they're fatally ill. But second of all, you know, guys don't usually do that. When I was writing this book, I got swine flu in London and was flat on my back for 3 days and, you know, could have sworn I was going to die and didn't do anything because I thought, you know what, I'll be fine, I'll write it out, and I did.
Wow.
And I think a lot of that was Jim just thought, you know, I'll be fine. I just, you know, when they would check on him, he was in the bath or he was laying down, you know, just sort of trying to do what you do when you feel sick, writing it out. He thought he had the flu. With sort of flu-like symptoms. There are times when, you know, you read the story and you're reading through his medical files where he would talk about coughing blood, and that's when you think, my God, you know, that's when you probably should have done something. But, you know, just didn't think it was that serious. And by the time he realized it was serious and went to the hospital, it was too late. His system had just been so seriously compromised by a massive strep infection.
In writing this book, Brian, you were allowed access to Jim Henson's personal archives. You looked through his diaries, his scripts, his proposals for movie and television shows, many of which never went anywhere. What did you find that really surprised you? Like, oh, I never knew that.
Well, there were sort of two things, and you know, there are things you suspect, but they sort of got confirmed when I was doing the research on it. Is one is what an outstanding businessman he was. And you sort of have an inkling of that because there's no way you can have a company that's sort of straddling the ocean with offices in New York and London unless you're a good businessman. But Jim was great at it from the time he was 17, 18 years old and formed his own company. I mean, he told his agent Bernie Brillstein when he was like 21 years old and had an enormous offer to sell Rolf the Dog to the Purina Dog Chow Company. They were going to pay him something like $150,000, which was a ton of money in 1961. And Bernie Brillstein was ready to take it, and Jim said to him, you know, Bernie, never sell anything I own. I mean, Jim knew early on his work had value. And so when it came time to merchandise Sesame Street, The Muppet Show, Jim owned all those characters. So, you know, the guy knew his work had value very early on. So he was an extraordinarily good businessman. The second thing is I had no clue. What really surprised me is how almost pathologically conflict-averse he was. You know, Jim wouldn't fight. He and his wife didn't always get along, but Jim wouldn't fight with her, which would just make her crazy. You know, that was something that you just didn't do. You didn't fight. You didn't get upset, you know, and it sort of crept into his business side of things when he would have to discipline employees. Jim just couldn't do that. He didn't understand why people couldn't just work and get along and, you know, why there had to be disagreement. So those are two of the things that sort of really surprised me about him. You sort of have an inkling again. I mean, you can't do the things Jim does on Sesame Street in The Muppet Show without being sort of a genuinely good guy. But, you know, he was so genuinely good that he just didn't want to have the disagreement. It was not something he was wired to do.
Well, the book is about an extraordinary life, the man behind the Muppets, Jim Henson. Brian J. Jones put together this biography, and when I say it's in-depth, I mean it is in-depth. And congratulations on that, and thanks so much for joining me here today.
Oh, this is great. It's my pleasure. Thanks.
I'm Paul Harris. This is America Weekend.